The next case on our calendar is 07-1802 and 1852, State of Ohio versus Howard Clay. Mr. Sweeney.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Colin Sweeney. I represent the appellant Howard Clay in this case. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case asks this court to decide whether an individual can be convicted of having a weapon under disability when he is unaware of the factual basis of the disabling condition. Specifically, in terms of this case, whether or not Mr. Clay can be convicted of having a weapon under disability when the disability is a pending indictment and there is no evidence that he had any knowledge of that pending indictment. I'm going to first address that question and then turn to a question of what the remedy would be if this court agrees. Mr. Clay submits that a conviction under these circumstances, that there's two problems with it. Number one, as a matter of statute, of statutory interpretation, the having a weapon under disability statute requires proof of knowledge of the disabling condition, in this case, a pending indictment. Secondly, if this court did not view the statute that way, that the Constitution would preclude his conviction under these circumstances. The statute at question.
A question
in this
occurred
case,
to me is would even a, if we accept your argument, would even a pending indictment be sufficient? He's not been convicted yet of anything.
Well, Your Honor, I might argue that in a different case, that a pending indictment itself would not be enough. This court has decided in a previous case that not only is a pending indictment enough, that if you're ultimately acquitted of that charge, you can still be found guilty of having a weapon under disability. So I don't know that I have anywhere to go with that, but I do think that at a minimum, you need to know that you're under indictment.
But the statute really says a person shall knowingly, have, carry, or use a firearm. So doesn't the knowledge or the culpable state of knowledge relate to the carrying or the use of the firearm?
And
the condition precedent then is if the person is under indictment. It doesn't say if the person knows that they are under indictment. In other words, the knowledge isn't repeated in the condition.
I agree that that's the way the statute is written. There's no question. But I do think that this case is very analogous to, and the statute is very similar to, the State versus Jordan case. The statute is written similarly, where it says no person shall acquire, have, use, possess a dangerous ordinance. And so in that case, the court interpreted knowingly to apply both to the act of possession, but also to the knowledge of the facts that make the possession of the item illegal.
But isn't the unstated culpable mental state, doesn't it revert to recklessness as to whether the individual would or would not be reckless in regard?
If indeed the statute as it's interpreted does not include a mental state as to a particular action, it would revert to recklessness. But I would suggest that in this case, the knowingly, the phrase adverb knowingly is meant as a matter of interpretation of the statute to apply both to the act of possession and to the knowledge of the underlying facts that make the possession illegal.
So if an individual has been arrested for a drug offense and has been bonded out, he may or may not assume that he will ultimately be indicted at some point in the future.
Correct.
Based on the arrest.
Correct.
Would he not then be reckless with respect to knowingly carrying a concealed weapon?
I don't believe he would be in those circumstances, because the question is he reckless with respect to knowing that he's under, or not knowing, reckless with respect to whether or not he's under indictment. I think when somebody, in a circumstance where there are charges pending against him at the time, and he's not straight released, as is the case here, an argument, I think a strong argument would be made, he's reckless in that circumstance. But even then, I think one of the difficulties is, obviously, he's still legally and indeed constitutionally protected to carry a firearm until there is a point at which he's indicted. And in because of the nature of indictments, obviously it's returned in secret. It's not something he participates in, even could participate in if he wanted to.
I wanted to follow up on that. Can you help me understand what happens after the indictment is rendered by the grand jury? When does the defendant get knowledge of that typically?
Typically they send a summons for the arraignment and the indictment to a person's address.
Here he was arraigned sometime quite a time after the indictment.
Right. What happened in this case is the indictment was mailed out. It was returned unclaimed, and so nothing happened with respect to that case. He had a warrant issued for him, and then at some point in time, after the incident in which he fired the gun and used the gun and caused the felonious assault in this case, he was then arraigned on the drug case after that point. But it bears emphasis too that in the state's presentation of evidence in this case, none of those circumstances were presented to the trier of fact. There's nothing about whether or not the defendant got notice or whether or not the indictment was actually mailed in this case. They didn't present anything on that point. And indeed, they've never contested that the evidence is insufficient if knowledge is required. They simply argue that knowledge is not required with respect to the indictment.
It's interesting that all of interesting to me at least, that all of the conduct listed in 1 and 2 under 13 are acts of which the defendant would know he has participated. Fugitive from justice, we think he would know that. Been adjudicated delinquent child, would know that if committed by an adult, and has been convicted of a felony offense of violence, he would probably know that. The only one that has this knowledge question is the indictment. You haven't argued this, but do you draw any strength from that? The fact that the statute seems to anticipate conduct that the defendant would know about.
I do think that makes the argument stronger with respect to the indictment language, because I think the legislature understands and the General Assembly understands exactly and would not intend an outcome that would occur where you would criminalize activity that's not only legal but constitutionally protected when the defendant does not have a criminal mental state. And here, if the state were correct, that would be the outcome. And I think that that's one reason that, although we think that this statute is not ambiguous, that knowingly applies to both the possession and the fact that makes it illegal, unambiguous, I'm sorry.
Finish that up.
I was going to say, to the extent that it was unambiguous, the rules of construction would suggest that you would want to avoid any constitutional problems with the construction that would remove criminal intent in this case, Your Honor.
You said he had no criminal intent. He had criminal intent on the night in question. He just didn't have any knowledge that his criminal intent would lead to a second penalty.
He had no criminal intent as to the offense of having a weapon under disability. There's no question he had criminal intent with respect to the shooting, but he had no criminal intent to possess this weapon illegally.
And the operational law gives him an extra 3 years, no way out,
right,
for the conduct.
Correct. I mean, with the gun specification, yes, he got 3 years. I do want to emphasize real quickly the due process concerns here, and that's that if this court were to determine that there was no culpable mental state required here, that there would be a due process concern, both with the right to notice, which is the right to have notice of your pending indictment, because it's a fundamental principle that you obviously, you can't confine yourself to what the law requires unless you know the facts that would make your conduct illegal. And it also ties into the notion that is fundamental, and that's that strict liability crimes are disfavored. while they certainly exist, there is due process limitations on them. And one of the things this court points out in Jordan is any statute that specifically includes a mental state, like this one, includes knowingly. It would be inconsistent with the legislature's intent to read the statute in such a way that there is no culpable mental state. So if you read the statute just to say, oh, you only have to prove he knowingly possessed this weapon, you know, there's no evidence that he did so with a criminal intent. And so that is inconsistent with notions of due process.
Counsel, let me ask you a factual question, and I haven't been able to find it in looking through the briefs. When he was initially, was he initially arrested for the drug charge in which he was indicted, or was it a secret indictment?
In the reason you probably didn't see it, because it's not in the transcript, but I do know he was arrested for, he was arrested and straight released. Like he
okay,
was,
that's what I, yes. I got from your prior, or your first remarks, and then I went and looked back just to ascertain. If he was arrested for the drug and he's out on bond or straight release or however, you know, he's waiting for the other shoe to drop with an indictment.
Perhaps, or perhaps, you know, I mean, as is the case here, they ultimately dismissed this indictment on the drug offense.
When did they do that?
After his conviction in this case. But I mean, you know, there are times when, in the case here, was a minor crack rock. I mean, it's not unheard of that the state wouldn't pursue criminal charges in some of these cases. And in fact, I think a reasonable defendant would say, oh, I was arrested, I was released, maybe I'm going to be criminally charged, but I don't necessarily know it's going to be a felony indictment. Number one, it could be, he could be charged in municipal court.
So, but knowing I have this hanging over my head, I'm still going to carry a weapon?
I'm not saying it's a good choice. There's no question that this individual made a number of bad choices. But what I'm saying is he doesn't have the requisite criminal intent. And quickly, I want to touch on what happens if this court agrees with me and reverses the conviction. The question is, does he go back for resentencing on the remaining counts, the felonious assault counts? And this court clearly answered in State versus Saxon that if there's in a multi-count case, if there's an error in the sentencing, in just the sentence of one of the counts, it doesn't go back on the other ones. And that makes sense. It's an interpretation of Ohio Senate Bill 2 and the notion that every sentence stands alone. However, when you're sentencing somebody in a criminal case, you take into consideration, and indeed statutorily you're required to take into consideration his criminal history, his other convictions. So unlike sentences, which do not permeate from one to the other, a criminal conviction does do that. So when you get when he was sentenced in this case, the trial judge said, okay, he not only engaged in the illegal act of shooting someone, felonious assault, but he was also guilty of having a weapon under disability. He should not even have had that gun in the first place. And because that was wrong, if this court finds that was wrong to convict him of this, and he incorrectly relied on that, and it does have an effect on his sentence, his remaining sentences should be vacated and gone back for resentencing. This is a distinct difference from the circumstances in State versus Saxon.
Should the county get to, or the state get to, reactivate the crack charge then?
I think they probably dismissed it without prejudice. So my guess is at any time they could, barring statute of limitations. Yeah. Barring the statute of limitations or barring the speedy trial. I don't think the statute of liberty would factor in. But they could bring it back if they wanted to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Mr. Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Thorin Freeman, on behalf of William Mason and the state of Ohio. We're asking this court to adopt two propositions of law today. First proposition is that the word knowingly, contained within a distinct division within 2923.13 statute, does not apply to any subdivision. The second proposition is that the legislature's decision not to insert a mens rea in any subdivision does not violate due process. The first issue is the certified question. And this court in Maxwell addressed a similar case where there was a mens rea within a statute's division, but in no subdivisions. This court held that because the mens rea was in the division, but not in the subdivisions, that structure was an indication to impose strict liability within the subdivisions, and that's ultimately was the holding of that case in Maxwell. The same thing applies here. Knowingly is, as Justice O'Donnell pointed out, it's set off by commas, knowingly possess, use, carry, or acquire, and then firearm or dangerous ordnance. And that's set off by a comma if any of the following apply subdivisions.
What is your response to my observation that all of the examples of conduct in 1 and 2 are conduct that are overt, essentially overt, at least conduct in which the defendant would have knowledge, of which you would have knowledge?
A defendant could have knowledge, but there's also, I think if you accept Clay's position today, that knowingly goes to A3, this is sort of the issue here. It also goes to A1, 2, 4, and 5. It's hard not to argue that. And the last one is a mental incompetence, if you've been adjudicated to be a mental incompetent. And sort of that idea of knowledge wouldn't coincide with that subdivision. It seems highly unlikely that the legislature would have intended that without so stating, well, it's knowingly in 1, 2, 3, and 4, but not 5. So there are other subdivisions that go against that. As a general rule, I think people know about their indictments, and that is definitely a concern.
But for the most part, what would be the rationale for the General Assembly making something a crime for which one part of that a person wouldn't know about? I mean, in terms of the strict liability argument, in this case, apparently the facts that we have to work with are that he did not know he was under indictment. Apparently not even any information whether he was reckless in that regard. So what rationale, what purpose would the General Assembly have for making somebody guilty of a crime for something they don't even know exists?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First, I'll address the reckless issue. This court clearly rejected that argument in Maxwell. The when you apply that statute, if there's a mental state anywhere in the statute, you cannot revert to reckless in any other place. It's either the mental state that's already there or it's nothing. It cannot be reckless. And the second issue is, in regards to the statute, these are dangerous items. And specifically, 2923.17, which this court addressed in Jordan, prohibits the possession of a dangerous ordnance. It's a flat prohibition against that. It is already criminal conduct. This, and that's a felony of the fifth degree. This simply enhances that person's penalty under the law if they are under indictment. The legislature has the right to determine where a mental element needs to go in a crime. And in this case, by not putting it in the statute, in the subdivisions, they've made that indication. And if you look at other statutes where there are other statutes that plainly indicate that a mental state is to go through all the subdivisions. Some of the more obvious ones are drug trafficking.
But you argue that knowingly only applies to the current possession of the weapon and not to knowing about the indictment. So therefore, by analogy, your argument is that there is no mental state, which then requires that part of it to go to reckless, because you're arguing knowingly doesn't apply to knowing about the indictment. So then reckless would apply because it is silent.
I disagree with that, Your Honor, and that's, again, that's Maxwell. That was what the appeals court in Maxwell had held under that minor child pornography case, was that, well, it's knowledge of the material involved, and you have to be reckless that it was brought into the state. This court clearly rejected that and said, no, because there is a mental element in the section, we do not apply reckless. It cannot be applied. There was a confusion between section and subsection, or what I've called division and subdivision.
And so what did we hold in Maxwell as to carrying it into the state?
That it was strict liability.
Because it was strict liability to possess, and therefore strict liability to bring it in?
No, it wasn't strict liability to possess. You had to have knowledge of the character of the material involved. That person had to know that he was dealing with a minor and nudity-oriented material. That's why the knowingly applied to that.
I have a hard time understanding how you get to strict liability here when the only other standard in the statute is a knowing standard.
The knowing standard does not apply. It is within its discrete clause. That was its holding in Max. That's what this court's holding in Maxwell is. It goes to that discrete clause. And I want to make this clear, because I think my position has been misstated a few times. I do not argue that it is simply possessing a weapon that makes you guilty of this offense. This court made that clear in Jordan. The state is required to prove that he possessed it, knowingly possessed it, and he's, I'm also required to prove that, one, he either knows it's a firearm, as that's been defined, he knows that it's capable of operation, or two, he knows what he has as a dangerous ordinance. So within that context, this is not a strict liability offense. It is not mere possession. This court will also look at other...
But the offense here is not owning a weapon or carrying a weapon. The offense is having it under disability. That's the problem, isn't it?
For a firearm...
That's the indictment issue.
For a firearm, perhaps, but the legislature has chosen to insert a firearm or dangerous ordinance. Or dangerous ordinance, and that is already a crime in and of itself, a possession. The legislature has determined the morally blameworthy conduct is the possession of the item. That's why they chose not to insert mens reas in the rest of it. They've already decided where the moral culpability lays, and it lays in possession of the item. We know that because they said so in 2923.17, and they made it illegal to possess a dangerous ordinance. It would be inconsistent that they meant one thing for a firearm and one thing for a dangerous ordinance.
What do we do with sealed indictments? Oftentimes in a sting operation, the grand jury will return indictments, but they're filed in the clerk's office and never opened. They might sit there for months.
Absolutely. I want to make this point clear because I think it's been misstated in the briefs. This idea that you have to be aware of your indictment, even if this court is to decide with Clay, that is not the standard. That is not how the legislature has defined knowledge. Knowledge is a person has knowledge of circumstances when he is aware that such circumstances probably exist. If you engage in drug trafficking, if you engage in a crime of violence, again, now the arrest is, I think, an easy one. Obviously, you've been arrested, you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. I believe that's easy. The question becomes, well, they don't know that the police are onto them. Well, that's a consequence of committing drug offense. That's a consequence of committing drug crimes of violence. Somebody will go to the police. The police may know about it, and you could be indicted. If you commit those crimes, and then you have a weapon, and you know you have a weapon, you are guilty of having a weapon under disability.
That's not what the statute says. That's a fairly robust rewriting of the statute, isn't it? Statute says under indictment. And Justice O'Donnell's question was, what about the secret indictment where the defendant, the subject of the indictment, doesn't know he's been indicted?
The legislature does not require the state to prove that he knows he's under indictment. The statute just says is under indictment.
Well, but so he's going to be charged with a crime with no notice. Conduct, he's engaged in conduct and he has no notice that that conduct may violate the statute.
There are other statutes that require that, and there are statutes that have stiffer penalties that require that. An individual can engage in consensual sex with somebody who's under 13, have no idea that that person is under 13, and they'll be subject to a 10-year penalty, a 10-year sentence in prison. So, I mean, it happens. There are statutes that do this.
Well, Counselor, getting back to one facet of your argument there, if the individual is going to engage in illegal activity, what you're saying, there's always the cloud of a indictment over their head, whether they know about it or not, if it's a secret indictment, or if they're arrested, as in this case, released, and then you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. But if you know that you're engaged in illegal conduct, you're saying that's enough of a warning, or should be enough of a enough support to allow for the defendant to be charged with this indictment clause.
The legislature has written as much. The legislature knows that indictments are issued in secret. They knew that when they wrote the statute. They've amended it twice. They've never inserted a mens rea. That is the legislature's province to determine what culpable mental state attaches to an element of a crime. In this case, they've chosen no culpable mental state to the element of under indictment. That's their province. There are three other questions that this court will generally look to in determining whether a legislature intends to pose strict liability. And those are the objects sought to be obtained, the legislative history, and the laws on same or similar subjects. Again, we discussed a little bit about what the law is trying to prohibit here. It's firearms. That's a heavily regulated industry, heavily regulated. This concept that it's perfectly legal to carry a firearm, I disagree with. It can be legal. I have no problem with that. But there are generally hoops that someone must go through. For instance, when I walked into this courthouse today, there's a big sign that says no weapons permitted. I can't have a firearm in this courthouse. I can't have a firearm in a liquor establishment. If I don't have a concealed carry license, I can't carry the weapon. Possessing a firearm alerts somebody to regulation. Again, dangerous ordinance is already a crime in and of itself. This simply enhances the penalty. The legislative history, they've amended the statute several times. They've never inserted a mens rea into any subdivision. Not one time. And that is, again, an indication that they intend to impose strict liability on these subsections. We've talked about laws on the same or similar subjects, and again, these are heavily regulated items. Real quickly to the due process claim, the United States Supreme Court has held there's no constitutional right to a mens rea. There's no constitutional right to a mens rea. And this court has adopted and indicated other statutes that impose strict liability and has upheld those. This statute survives a due process claim.
Do you think we are not bound by Staples? I know you think Staples doesn't apply, but do you think we're not bound by it if we decide that it applies?
For two reasons, this court isn't bound by Staples. One, this court's already determined that it's not bound by Staples. That was in State versus Jordan. It distinguished Staples for a couple of reasons. One, that is how the United States Supreme Court interprets their own statutes. It may not affect how this court interprets its statutes. It's persuasive authority, I'm not arguing that, and the other reason is Staples wouldn't apply because that is a statute that has no mens rea anywhere in it, the part they were dealing with. They have different rules of statutory construction. They have different things they need to take into account. So it doesn't apply. So this court has already, I don't want to say rejected it outright, but has limited at the application of Staples. And Staples isn't instructive on the issue because in Staples, they talk about a case called United States versus Freed, where an individual was in possession of a hand grenade, and he claimed, "Well, I didn't know I had to register it." Well, they said, "We don't care. You know, you don't have to know that you have to register it. You know, and that's here. You don't have to know that you're under indictment. The legislature has chosen not to insert a mens rea there." Real briefly, I want to get to the issue of, and this probably is not important, but his drug trafficking case was dismissed with prejudice. Our cops were unable to come because these things were joined for trial. We had presented a witness and jeopardy had attached. So we are out of that drug trafficking case. I just wanted to make that clear to the court. In closing, I would ask that this court continue to apply Maxwell and the case it relies on, WAC, though that case provides clear guideposts for trial courts to know how to interpret statutes. Mr. Clay's interpretation will confuse this area of precedent and make it harder for trial courts to do their jobs. Based on that, we'd ask that the 8th District be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Mr. Sweeney, you've saved a little more than a minute of your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Sweeney, would you address the question that I asked opposing counsel, that if you engage in criminal activity, you do so at your own peril, that there may be a pending indictment hanging over your head at some point, and I guess that that's the argument here.
Well, I think that may be enough to satisfy recklessness, because I still think knowledge that you are actually under indictment, you don't have that, number one, from allegedly engaging in criminal activity.
But you know yourself as the defendant, I sold crack or I, whatever the activity, you know you did it.
Well, I think that the situations are often more complicated than that. You know, a lot of times defendants are charged with crimes. There's probable cause to prove that, and they're ultimately acquitted. And I think that that's one of the particular problems with the state's construction of this statute, because you would have a situation where somebody was charged with the crime, didn't know they were charged with, indicted, and then ultimately acquitted of that charge, but still be convicted of having a weapon under disability. I think that creates a host of constitutional problems, not the least of which.
But that's not what we have here, and do we even need to address that situation, that scenario?
Well, I think that in fashioning the rule in this case, I mean, I think you need to think about its application to other circumstances. But even if you just look at this circumstance, I still think you have a situation where I agree that firearms are regulated. There's no question about that. But the question is whether, there's also no question that they're constitutionally protected. And as long as he's complying with the regulations, and the only thing that's suggested is illegal here, is that he's possessing this firearm without while he's under the indictment. But he doesn't know he's under indictment. So basically, you have a situation.
So you're saying he was legally possessing the firearm. He had no.
As far as the record reflects, I don't know. I mean, perhaps he didn't have the necessary permits. But if he didn't, then he could be charged for that. There's no suggestion in this case that there was anything that made the possession of this weapon illegal other than the secret, or not secret, the indictment of which he was unaware. And I think that when you have a situation like this where there is, again, I can't get away from the fact that the basic principle of our justice system, and there are exceptions, but is that there is a culpable mental state in most all crimes, and particularly in a situation like this where there is a culpable mental state in the statute. I think you would have to effectively overrule Jordan in order to come to a situation where you say the knowingly only applies to the possession of the weapon and not to the fact that makes the possession of the weapon illegal. Because Mr. Freeman compares firearms and dangerous ordinances and moves between them. Dangerous ordinances might be precluded from possessing because of their inherently dangerous nature, and the legislature has made that illegal. But firearms are a different story. They're, as I said, constitutionally protected, and there's no crime to possessing a weapon, a firearm, I mean, inherently. There has to be something else, and he has to know what that something else is in order to be convicted.
You've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted, and you'll be advised of our opinion.